Welcome to Talaterra, a podcast about freelance educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. Who are these educators? What do they do? Join me and let's find out together. This is your host, Tanya Marion. Today, my guest is Alice Mary, co-founder of Museo Huaca, a pop-up participatory museum delighting communities in Lima, Peru. I reached out to Alice to learn how the museum was created, how it earned the trust of established museums, and how it won the hearts of local residents. How did Museo Huaca learn to work with museums? What has been the museum's most successful approach to sponsorships? What's next for this community-oriented museum post-pandemic? Let's find out. Thank you, Alice, for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking time to talk about your museum work.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure to speak to you.
May I ask you to introduce yourself to listeners?
Yeah, sure. My name's Alice Mary. And I work most of the time, my main job is that I work in financial inclusion and sustainable finance. I work to try and make finance have a more positive role in our societies and in our environment, in our planet. But apart from that, I'm also a complete history geek. I did my undergraduate degree in Roman and ancient Greek history and languages. I still study at the moment. Now I'm based in Peru. So I study Peruvian archaeology now. So I'm a real history geek and I love to share that with people. So I set up a project called Museo Huaca in Spanish, Museum Huaca, which is what I'm here to speak to you today about.
It's a fascinating museum and initiative that you have. You have, as you describe on your website, you just come right out of the box and say how it's different. You don't have a collection. And you don't have a building, you start with the visitor. It's a fine example of free choice learning where choice and control rest with the visitor. You start with the visitor. So let's go back to the beginning of this project. How did this project start with you?
It's interesting because, Daniel, when we were speaking just before this podcast, you asked me kind of how I think of myself and how I like to present myself in terms of the work I do in finance or in terms of the work I do with museums. And actually kind of occurred to me now that in a way, the work that I'm doing now with Huaca, with museums, with heritage, is kind of influenced by my experience of finance, because I worked a lot in the microfinance sector and in financial inclusion. And this is all about getting bank services out to people who don't have access to a brick and mortar bank. So what do you do when there's not a physical bank in a neighborhood? Maybe it's a very rural area in a developing country where there's not banking infrastructure. How do you get those services out to people? And I suppose that really influenced my take on museums and heritage as well, because I live in Lima in Peru, which is a city with incredible museums. I mean, really top world-class museums. Some of my favorite museums in the whole world are in Lima. It has, you know, the most incredible historical objects, the most gorgeous museums, but they're really concentrated in areas where they're only accessible to quite a small amount of the population. And so with my co-founder, we started thinking about how can we get museums out to people who can't get to museums. I guess my experience in microfinance and financial inclusion kind of came in there because I thought, well, you don't build banks. That's never the solution, really. And in the same way, I think you don't build museums where museums aren't necessarily. I mean, it would be fabulous if we had tons of money and maybe we could have done that. But like you say, we don't have any of the things that typically identify a museum. We don't have a permanent collection. We don't have any collection. We don't have any building. So how do we get museum experiences and heritage experience out to where there's no physical museum infrastructure. And that was really our starting point.
And how long ago did you start Museum Waka?
We started talking about it and thinking about it about 3 years ago. And right in the beginning, we just wanted to start thinking about why people weren't going to museums, why, what we could do about it. And so we started off just by speaking to people, really. And we started going out into areas where we knew from, you know, prior research that had been done. There's some really good research on museum visits in Lima. And so we knew about the areas of Lima that are very, where people are very unlikely to be visiting museums. And so we really just went and spoke to people in those areas. We did also quite a cool experiment where we talked to people just outside a park, in a park just outside of a museum, about why they didn't visit that very museum. And we started to find out some of the reasons that people weren't visiting museums. And this was things like, for people who obviously weren't in that park right outside the museum, but people who lived in more distant suburbs, said to me, I can't even afford the bus fare to get to the museum. It would take me 2 hours and so many soles to get that bus fare. That's completely out of my possibilities. And even for people who could visit museums, they would say things to us like, oh, I don't feel like they're for me. They're always the same. Why would I go now if I could go next year? Probably I went with school and I've never been since and I doubt it's changed. And one thing that was really, really interesting to me that people said as well was around shame. And especially parents would say to me, like, I don't want to take my kids to a museum because they're going to ask me questions about my own country's history and I'm not going to know the answer. And I'm going to feel ashamed and I'm going to feel awkward. And it's not an environment I feel comfortable in. And so, yeah, that was really the starting of Waka, was that realization that there was two big challenges. And one of them was just practicality, just distance, just infrastructure. And the other were this kind of emotional barriers around shame and discomfort and lack of interest. And so those were the barriers we tried to tackle.
And then what did you do next?
Yeah, so we started Waka in a really interesting time in Peru. So I don't know whether any listeners will know that Peru experiences a climatic event called El Niño, which means that every few years we have enormous flooding down the coast of Lima, sometimes landslides, all kind of strange climatic events. And actually we started Waka up around the time that hit. And so we, right in the beginning, we were kind of firstly trying to overcome these barriers I'd already mentioned, and we're also suddenly finding ourselves in a reality where there was really bad situation in a lot of Lima and a lot of the city and a lot of the coast of Peru, where people's homes had been destroyed through mudslides, through flooding. And there was, yeah, really, really difficult time in the country. So we kind of also wanted to reach out to people who were having a really bad time because of that. And we actually ended up doing our very first, what we came to call a pop-up museum, but I don't even think we had that word for it at the time, in the garage of a house in an informal settlement where there'd been a lot of flooding. So we went with a local artist. We didn't even have any objects. Later we started working with objects, but we actually just had pictures and a local artist. And we went and took some iconography to do with the water and the sea, because that had become such a kind of big part of what people were experiencing at that time. And we did an art project with the kids, and we turned this garage into an art exhibition, and we invited all the local parents and the local communities to come and visit the art exhibition. So that was our very first ever, what came to be a pop-up museum, although I don't think we called it that at the time.
How did you tell the community about this event that you were going to hold?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing in trying to work in these kind of scenarios is that there's not a lot of formal organization. So that was a challenge for us at first. We thought, how are we going to contact with this community? How are we going to talk to them? How are we going to tell them we want to have this event? And, you know, I suppose as a kind of person used to using the computer and the internet for everything, your instinct is, you know, look them up, look up the community, look up who's in charge, talk to the authorities. That doesn't work. It's not, at least in a time of crisis, right, which this was, we weren't going to find the some kind of a formal organization. At least we weren't going to find it by Googling it. So in the end, we just drove there and we just started to talk to people. And we said, you know, who's in charge? Like, who can help us, you know, if we want to organize something? And so person to person passed us between them until we found this lady who was kind of running an informally running support for the residents, as she was a local resident, and she was just helping kind of coordinate supplies that were being sent to the community to help them. And luckily her house hadn't been destroyed by the flood, so she offered us her garage. And she went round basically with a clipboard, like registering local children to come. So really, we just had to turn up and find out who could help us coordinate. I mean, in future ones, we were working with slightly more formal organizations and it was a bit easier. But in that very first instant, it was very, very informal.
Yeah, grassroots all the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we stayed in touch with her afterwards and she sent us photos on WhatsApp and kind of, yeah.
Oh, nice fun. So how much lead time did you have before you actually had your event?
I think that was about a week. We met her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. Yeah, we hired a little mini bus and we bought the art supplies and the artist. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Wow. And the turnout, what was the turnout like?
And we had a lot of kids. We did two sessions. We probably had 50 kids altogether. And it was quite a learning experience for us because I think perhaps we were a bit naive as well. And I think that what we did was useful and the children enjoyed it. And we established a positive relation with the community and we stayed in touch with them and so on. But when we went, we bought, you know, for example, we bought art materials with us, like art pastels and things. And we worked with the art teacher and we bought snacks with us for the sessions. And after the session, especially the older kids, kind of like young teenagers, came up to us and said, can I keep the art stuff? Can I keep the pastels? And I think we hadn't realized that enough. And this was really kind of our failing, really, that how much these kids had lost and how much, you know, they enjoyed the session. But when we were able, thankfully, we just kind of scurried around and tried to find enough art materials to give everyone who wanted something. But that was maybe kind of, I think, a really value to them as a possession, also some kind of a sense of like privacy or personal creation that they had, to have a notebook and have some art materials and have a space to do something creative on their own. And that was definitely something that we hadn't realized. If I'd done it again in that kind of more urgent disaster scenario, then I would have purposefully organized to bring supplies and have left things with the children to keep using afterwards.
Yeah. And how long afterwards did you hold your second event?
I don't remember exactly, but it probably would have been a few months afterwards that we did the next formal event. And by then it started taking on a bit more the shape that they've taken since then, where with a little bit more time to organize, we set up a collaboration with museums. So normally now what we do is we will set up a partnership with the museum for a particular pop-up topic. So say we might do something about portraits, the Incas created portraits in the form of vessels. So we might think about portraiture and work with a museum that has an amazing collection of those kind of objects. And we would talk with them to kind of develop the topic. And they would also, they usually lend us replicas. We don't really use real objects because it's a bit stressful and also unnecessary, really, for what we want to do. So we'd borrow like 3 or 4 or 5 replica objects. And then we'd set up a kind of interactive art activity around the topic. And we'd take it to really any place where people already are. That's the main thing that we try and do. So we don't ever want to sign people up and tell them to come somewhere. You know, we will just turn up where people already are. So we do our events in shopping centres. We've done them on the beach. We do them at kind of popular events that are already happening. And we just turn up and put up these kind of pop-up museums. And the idea is we only start out with 4 or 5 replica objects and activity. And throughout the day, as the families participate, they create pieces of art that become the museum. So by the end of the day or of the 2 days, we have a pop-up museum that we've created among the people who participated and created their artworks. And we don't have labels on the objects either. So people come and they write on sticky notes their own labels, how they interpret the objects, stick them on. We encourage the kids to touch the objects, to take them around. We've only broken 2 things, I think. Usually they survive.
Oh, fantastic. And then the people who create objects, they can, after the end of the day or at the end of the weekend event, they can take their objects home?
That's a good question. We slightly underestimated that people would want to do that because we thought that we were going to create the displays with their beautiful objects. And people are willing to if they can come back and get them at the end of the day. But, you know, the 10-year-olds are really proud of what they made and they don't want to leave it behind. So, yeah, people usually come back at the end of the day or the end of the weekend and pick up whatever they created. If some other kid hasn't painted all over the top of it, which does happen sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. How many of you work these events? How many people are involved with Museum Waka?
We have about, people have come and gone a bit, but there's a core team of about 3 of us, myself and 2 others, that we kind of run the events, plan the events, set up the partnerships, design the activities. And then on any particular event, we'll probably have, I found that we need about 4 people present, either the core team or volunteers who work with us to make sure that it more or less functions. And the simpler the activity, if it's a simple activity, we can get away with 4. If you make the activity any more complicated, you start needing more people. Yeah. Usually.
So I'm hearing that you literally just appear. Okay. Mm. Instead of, you know, myself and people in my audience, you know, we sign up to be vendors, you know, there's vendor packets, there's whatever, at whatever events there are around town. And so we get, you know, we bring our booths, we haul all our, you know, stuff out there and do something there. But you sound, I'm hearing that you just show up. Do you need permits or anything like that to do what it is that you do when you do it that way?
Yeah, it's a good question and something that we kind of had to tackle in the beginning. It really depends. So when we do shopping centers, for example, we found that's a really good place to go because there is tons of families. There's tons of people already there. There's lots of bored children. So that's been quite a good place for us to go. And there we need the approval of the shopping center. But it's actually been pretty easy to get. We haven't been told no yet. Usually all they want to know is if we're going to sell anything, because if we're going to sell anything, then we compete with the vendors who they are charging to be there. But if we say we're not selling anything, you know, we can still maybe receive donations, but we're not selling anything, then on the whole, the shopping centers really like it because I suppose because it means that people spend longer there. They arrive with their families. They can, you know, maybe leave one of the parents and the kids doing the activity. The other parent can go off. You know, it keeps people there longer. People respond really well to it. And it creates a kind of sort of slightly festival atmosphere in the shopping center. So I think that they like that. And if we do it out in the open, it really depends. So some local councils require you to have permission. And some have much more stringent requirements than others. So to be honest, because we're a small team and we don't want to spend ages negotiating these things, we just tend to avoid places where it's really complicated for us to set up.
You made a comment, and it's very interesting to me that like the shopping center, for instance, they don't charge you the regular vendor fee because you're there as an educational experience. You're adding something, a different dimension to the event. I know that in the environmental ed field, when you do an event, sometimes, you know, everybody gets charged the same, no matter what your reason for being there at an event. So you can't be just strictly, you know, educational. You have to find something to sell so that you can make it worth your time, right? Or at least cover your booth fee and, you know, this, that, and the other. So that's interesting. That's very... very generous for the venue to work with you in that way.
Yeah, we've been lucky. I think we would struggle otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many museums do you work with?
We've worked with three, I think. So we have two private museums, smallish private museums in Lima, and then one in the on the north coast of Peru that we also work with. And we're planning an event, although, you know, coronavirus pending, we're planning an event in Cusco with the kind of religious museums of Cusco as well. So then that would be four.
How did you get the museums to see you as a community partner? And how did you work on gaining their trust?
Yeah, that was quite difficult. The first time I turned up, when it was, there was only two of us and we'd never done anything before. I mean, we'd done one. I told you the first event that we did wasn't without a museum collaborator. So the first time when we'd never worked with a museum before, I managed to get a meeting with a curator in a museum and I just turned up and I just thought we had such a great idea and I was going to explain it so enthusiastically to her and she was going to love it. And she basically said, like, where's your formal proposal? What numbers are you going to get? What's the branding going to be? She said, go away and send me a formal proposal. I mean, she said it much nicer than that. Not much nicer than that. But, and, you know, it's true. We did need all that. So then we went back. And I think that one of the things that really helped us get the partners was when we knew what venue we were going to be in, when we already had the agreement of the venue, and we started to get a feel for the numbers. So how many people go through that venue? What kind of an opportunity is that for you to reach them? And when we set out really clearly what we wanted from the museums, which actually wasn't that much, I mean, for them to lend us some replicas, have a conversation with us about the topic, maybe put it out on their social media and so on, it's not actually that much work for them. And I think what they're most concerned about is their brand. If they're putting their brand with your brand, are you going to treat it well? Are you going to cause them any problems? Do you seem kind of trustworthy with their brand? And so this kind of formal proposals, we started drawing up very formal proposals, especially in, I think different countries have different cultures around this, but Peru has quite a formal culture around proposal writing and so on. So we had to create these quite formal proposals. And once we'd done it a couple of times, it got much easier because we also started to really know the numbers. And if we do an event, say in an area that has high footfall, so in a shopping center, on a beachfront, somewhere like that where a lot of people go through, we can get 1,000 people in a day to interact with our museums. And most, especially a small private museum, doesn't get 1,000 visitors in a month. So we're saying, you know, we can share your heritage, everything that you try and promote, everything that's so important to your museum in one day with four volunteers, we can share it with 1,000 people. And I think it's that started to catch the interest of museums and make them want to collaborate with us.
That is wonderful. That's exciting. Mm-hmm. And how long did that take to develop? You've been doing this for 3 years. Did it take, not until your second year, did people start to begin to trust you, or how did that work?
Yeah, I think what it really took was one museum to trust us, and that probably took a year. I mean, it took doing it without a collaborator, then persuading a collaborator, then doing it, then telling them how, you know, and probably after the first year, I think we had quite a good partnership with the museum that initially told me to go away and come back when you're prepared to be serious, became a really good partner of ours. And they're a very, very well-respected museum in Lima. So once they were kind of on board with us, other museums would see that we did events with them and that our logo was on there, you know, that we were working with them. It got much, much easier for us. So by the second year, it got much easier for us to get museums to collaborate with us. I mean, our ongoing challenge, and I've mentioned it to you before, of course, is paying for this stuff. I mean, the museums collaborate, but museums' budgets are very small, and so they're not really paying for this kind of things. They're contributing in kind. They provide us with replica objects, with expertise, with help promoting the event. The real challenge for us at the moment is finding out people willing to collaborate and help pay for this. So that's our next challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yes, before we get to that.
Yeah. As for many people, it's a big one.
The objects that the museums lend you, are they from their permanent collections or are they in coordination with a current exhibition that they have?
So far, they've normally been their permanent exhibition. I think that sometimes if you work in a museum, you can think that the thing that you're famous for is quite boring, or like you get bored of it, I suppose. When I mentioned these portrait vases, which it's just our most popular event, and we've done it several times, there are these gorgeous kind of vases that have extremely lifelike face portraits on them. And they're very well known in Peru. And one particular museum is quite famous for having them. And so we take replicas of those, which very much part, I mean, it's not only their standard collection, it's kind of their, I don't know what you call it, their kind of main attraction, one of their main attractions, these pieces. But usually the people that we're taking it to, it's very new for them, very exciting and very out of the ordinary. And those tend to be the objects that they create commercial replicas of. So they'll often have them commercially. But it's interesting you ask about exhibitions, because something we would really like to do is start aligning the activities of WACA with exhibitions, so that it can be seen as part of a campaign. So that, you know, if a large museum in Lima launches an amazing exhibition about, you know, new finds about a certain culture, what if we could take that exciting new discovery, that new flagship exhibition, and take parts of it to through the whole country, or through, you know, certainly parts of the country where these kind of exhibitions would never normally get to. So I would really like to do that, but we haven't done it yet.
Do individuals from these museums join you at a venue?
Sometimes. Not really as the volunteers. Usually they come to check it out, to see what we're doing. They don't usually work as on the events with us. And I think it's quite a different skill, actually, to a lot of them. I mean, a lot of curators might not be used to working with small children on art projects. Maybe they don't feel super comfortable with that as an activity, but they do usually drop in and check what's happening.
Okay, so Museum WACA is in a very unique position. The museum has an opportunity to be the linchpin here, especially now with everything being closed. Mm-hmm. And there's concern about when people will return to visitor-serving organizations. How long will that take? And then which organizations will they go to, right? And so from the literature, the current articles being written, it appears that, yes, people will come back to the museums, to all these cultural institutions. But at the moment, there appears to be a preference for locations where there's freedom of movement, as opposed to going to an enclosed theater or something like that, because of virus concerns, of course, and concerns with large crowds. Where you work with community, there's freedom of movement. And WACA has the opportunity to keep museums top of mind so that people who may be intending to visit the museums can start to think about actually planning a visit, you know, and hopefully they would follow through with that visit. So that's a fantastic position. I mean, that's how I'm hearing it and how I'm seeing it. I think that's a fantastic opportunity for your initiative.
That's really interesting. I hadn't actually thought about what you just said about people preferring to go where there's more space and not be an enclosed museum. And I hadn't actually thought of that. And it's very true. That could be a fantastic opportunity to perhaps, when things start to open up, but they're not, people aren't completely comfortable yet. We'd have to see with the health concerns and everything, but that's really interesting to know. And I think there could be opportunities there. And I mean, we had planned this year possibly to start thinking about having a digital component to some of what we do. So we already, usually what happens when we have an in-person event is that there'll also be a certain amount of engagement on Facebook as well. That tends to be where our audience are, where they feel comfortable connecting with us. So we'll usually have a page, an event page for the in-person event, and people mostly put selfies. That's the most common. We try and get people to do other things, to like reply to questions or something, but mostly what people do is take selfies and put them on the Facebook page. But it's quite fun, and it does create an engagement. And I've been seeing more and more here that also educational, kind of extra educational content is being passed around through WhatsApp. parents are passing materials through WhatsApp. And so I did start to think, is there something that we can do through materials that can be shared on WhatsApp or through Facebook, small videos or some audio content, art activities? These are some of the ideas I'm starting to have in my head. And I think there is a space for that. Like you say, people would still like to be interacting with their heritage. And if they can't do it through a traditional museum environment, and they can't even do it through a kind of pop-up museum environment for now, what kind of channels of communication are there? And I think among the people that we usually work with, I do see that WhatsApp is particularly a strong channel, but we haven't worked out yet how to leverage that. But I think there should be something there, I think.
Yeah, because do you keep, I don't want to say, I know I'm thinking traditional here, a mailing list or a way to stay in contact with the people who have visited previous events?
We haven't had very much luck collecting email addresses. We have quite a lot of likes on Facebook. So that's been our main way. So we do also have an email list. It's not very big. So I think probably through our Facebook group would be the easiest way for us. Something also quite interesting I just wanted to add about the kind of digital engagement is that one of the things that people, especially the parents, most often say to us when we have an event is they'll say, oh, my grandmother has something like that. Or, oh, where I grew up, I saw objects like that. You know, people, maybe it's different in other countries, but in Peru, people have a very close connection with their heritage and a very close connection with, you know, people have historic objects in their houses, huacas, they call them here, historic objects. And quite widely in rural communities, people just have them in their homes. And so that's something that also people say to us, and they often post on Facebook, oh, I like that. My grandmother has something like that in her house, you know. And so I also think that's a real opportunity for people to kind of contribute their own experiences and their own, you know, what they know about these kind of objects and how they're used nowadays and so on. So I just wanted to add that as another thing that I think people use the digital channels for sometimes.
Have you ever measured conversion or do any type of like longitudinal study to see who your visitors to your events, do they go to the museums, and do you know of that at all?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is we don't really know. We have tried to measure it before, and the way that we tried to measure it in the past was doing like a discount code or a voucher or something. So we would do the museum pop-up in partnership with the museum, and then we would say, okay, you can have half price entry, or we run a competition or something, with the idea that if people go to the museum and use the voucher, we'll know. It didn't work very well. We didn't get very many people going to the museum, or if they did, they lost the voucher, I don't know, but we didn't get a very high conversion out of that. In that case, I don't know if it's to do also with where that particular museum was. It's in a very upmarket area. I don't know whether people would have felt comfortable or would have been close enough to go to that museum. But it is something I wonder about. I would like to be able to sell to museums that we will encourage people to actually go and visit the museums. And I hope that we can have that effect. But I do wonder a bit whether one or two pop-up experiences, you know, experiences of the kind of museums we do, is enough to change people's mind and their attitudes towards going to a traditional museum. And maybe we need something that links them better, like some kind of similar activity that then takes part in the museum that they're then invited to. I'm not sure, but I think in some cases the jump is still quite big between experiencing it on their own turf in a very interactive, very warm, very easygoing way to them making the decision to go to a traditional museum.
How difficult would it be, do you think, to collect email addresses or some way so that the museum then can turn around and offer extend a personal invitation to your visitors?
Yeah, I'm literally writing it down because it's a good idea. I think we could. Yeah, we definitely could. And it would be, yeah, interesting to see what they could then, that the museums could then offer them, knowing the experience that they've already had with us. And perhaps if we can give them feedback or what people have found interesting, excited, what people have engaged with, what they want to know more about, that would help the museums make an offer to them that would be more relevant, more appealing.
You have a background in museum studies. Have you ever conducted a visitor study at any of your events?
I've never actually studied museum studies. I only studied like history and archaeology. So, although museums kind of comes under that. So your question was if I'd ever conducted a visitor study
to see how visitors approach your museum, your pop-up museum, how they move through it, what they do while they're there, and how they, you know, and then how they leave, you know, how many participate, how many observe or help someone else in their group participate. And then also, you know, I'm thinking of the visitors' identity related motivations, why they went there on that day. You know, what was their reason for doing that? Or if you have any kind of a sense, you know, like that. How big is your pop-up museum, by the way?
So they're not very big. I mean, when I describe them, what you should maybe be imagining is, I mean, we make them out of, like, we have an architect who works with us, a really cool young guy, and he makes us these, like, movable, super light things. But they're basically made of, like, white polyester. I mean, they're not pretty. So you can imagine four, like, stands with objects on them. And then it depends where we are, because sometimes we're out in the open, we put out tables. If there's a wall, we'll use a wall. We've done things in these kind of dome tents where we clip things on the dome tents. But basically, you're imagining four or five stands with objects on, a few tables, a wall, and then people are just in kind of, I can tell you when you say how people move through it, it's interesting because we've tried a couple of times to have exhibitions, or not exhibitions, but activities, setups, where there is a set way to move through it, where you do one thing and then you do the second thing and then you do the third thing, and it's never worked for us. It's never worked. So I've completely given up on that. And I don't know if it's just because we're in this kind of very informal outside environment. I don't know if it's because the mix of ages we can't control. So we'll get everything from a 4-year-old to a 14-year-old. But what tends to happen is that people just start to get curious. Like they're not there to look for us, right? So they're doing their shopping, they're walking by the beach, they're hanging out at the weekend with their family. And usually we try and make them very colorful. Sometimes we just put balloons up and stuff, anything to catch people's attention. And people kind of just start, like, you know how people gather around buskers in the street? It's kind of like that. You sort of start to step around and they're peering. And then what are these strange people doing? And then we always have volunteers which have T-shirts which say Whacker on them. So people kind of know who they can talk to. One time we did it with clowns. That was amazing. We had a troop of clowns working with us. But anyway, we have people who kind of start to engage people, start to talk to them. And then people will usually come towards the objects that we have and we start a conversation with them. We ask them lots of questions. We will, if they have ideas and responses, sometimes we give them post-it notes and we'll ask them to stick their responses. And people get curious. They want to see what other weird, funny things other people have written. And then if they're more interested, they'll usually start to take part in whatever kind of activity we have going on. And something that I've really noticed is that in theory, we thought we were doing this for kind of 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, that kind of age group. And they want to join in and they want to be part of it. But it's also teenagers want to do art activities, and also the parents. It's quite funny how often, like, they want you to get their kid busy doing an art activity so they can do the art activity. And so the participation among adults and teenagers, and the thing that I find really intriguing about teenagers is they often stay for hours. We usually end up with a cluster of 14 or 15-year-olds who will stay for 2 or 3 hours doing the art. Then they'll take it off and do something completely that we hadn't imagined with it, but there's this real want to kind of engage deeply in the art aspect I see among the teenagers and the parents too sometimes. And also people often come and go. So they'll have a look, then they'll go off, then they'll come back, then they'll do an art activity, then they'll go off, then they'll find their cousin, then they'll bring their cousin back. They want to throw their cousin. So we do get people kind of coming and going from us. And you've made me think that it'd be very interesting to do a proper study of all this. But this is just some of my observations about how people interact with us.
Yeah. Oh no, that's good. That's all good stuff. It never turns out the way you envisioned it. I mean, it's a very dynamic situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, venues like that. Yeah. That's what makes it fun. It keeps you on your feet, thinking on your feet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's revisit the subject of funding just for a little bit. During work hours, you are an independent consultant in inclusive and sustainable finance. Those are your sectors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all three of us who are in the team have other jobs. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything in your experiences as a consultant that you might be able to draw upon and apply it to the development of Museum Waka?
Yeah, it's a very good challenge. I think that there should be more. So although it might seem that I should be the one who knows more about finance, my co-founder is probably actually better at this, possibly because I'm very used to working very big scale projects. And he's very used to working on small, like his background is in small rural community projects. And so he has a very good kind of, I think, a better sense of how to get these kind of small scale local funding. And I definitely started off looking for funding from foundations or charities or grants, possibly because that's the world, you know. It's not really what I work in, but for one reason or another, I do know that world a bit better. And I think the approach that we've moved towards, and this really comes from my co-founder, not from me, is looking for small local businesses that have an interest in the kind of quality of life and the cultural energy of the place where they're operating. And I once spoke to someone who's a brilliant museum manager in the UK, and we were just having an informal chat, and she was saying to me, businesses care about heritage in their area because heritage and art and all this kind of thing is what gives a place soul. So if you run a small local restaurant in a town, or if you run a business in a particular area of the city, what gives that area soul and it makes people want to live there, and makes people want to work there, and makes people want to spend money there is partly the arts and the heritage sector. And so my co-founder had the idea of reaching out to kind of local restaurants, local small businesses, even chains that are present in the area, and seeing whether they'd be interested in sponsoring us. And I would say that's the most successful approach we've taken up till now, has been the kind of much smaller businesses.
Yeah, and there's much interest in there, in your initiative, I'm sure. And I would like to also point out that for listeners, that the Museum Waka is an association, and you received in 2018 a Catalyst grant from the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturers, and Commerce.
That was fabulous for us. I mean, we received £2,000, which for us was enormous. I mean, that allowed us to do absolutely tons. Because we work in places where usually we're allowed to use the space for free, because most, you know, everybody who works with us is volunteers, and the museums collaborate with us, we don't actually need a great deal of money. So that £2,000 that we got from the RSA, the Royal Society of Arts, was huge for us. And that's really what allowed us to develop the pop-up museum methodology, test it, grow it in the first couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we were fortunate.
On a global scale, we are all facing a new normal. Mm. Okay. What's next will be different than what was. How do you think you might have to change how you interact with the people you serve?
I think I wonder whether there will be a move towards people staying within smaller geographical areas, at least for a while. So here, you cannot travel between cities or provinces in Peru. And I just think that people are spending more time in their own neighborhoods, spending more money locally because it's harder to move. I mean, just living more of their lives in a smaller area. And And that could have interesting consequences for us. I mean, in a way, anyway, what we try and do is take things to where people are already. So perhaps that's kind of a trend that works with what we do. Until now, we've been very, very much based on interaction. I mean, I really think that for example, we couldn't set up our pop-up museum and leave it for people to interact with. It absolutely depends on us being there, volunteers being there, talking to people, making jokes with people, encouraging them, asking them questions. And so I think without that personal interaction, I think, is what we bring and is what is sometimes not there in a traditional museum setting, or people don't expect to be there in a traditional museum setting. And so that if we can't do that, then we need to think really creatively about how to recreate that warmth and personal touch in a digital way, and not allow, you know, not end up going back to something that's quite cold and impersonal and brings back these feelings of shame and that we were trying to get away from. So we will have to be really, really creative, I think. What I mentioned about wanting to maybe put resources on WhatsApp or something is no good in and of itself if we're just putting stuff out there. It's really, how do we recreate that kind of interaction? I think that's something that, yeah, we definitely don't have answers to, but it's going to be interesting to think about.
What if you expanded your footprint at your events and created stations, one person working at each station, you know, as the guide at one station? Do you think that might work? Are you, when you work at the venues that you have worked at, is there a restriction in how much space you can take up, like a 10 by 10 canopy pent or 10 by, you know, 20 by 20, or is there some type of a restriction?
It depends. And in some places we could definitely spread out more. I think young children are quite chaotic, so I don't know how much success we'd have in, like I said, because people don't move through in a very orderly or very predetermined way. It might be difficult to control the chaos and keep the distance, but there might be ways. I mean, there might be ways to do sort of more smaller events, more spread out. But I guess if anybody's standing there interacting with somebody, it's very difficult to do that from 2 meters. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. No.
Good question.
Yeah. New things to think about for sure. Mm. I've come around to, after the initial shock, anxiety, panic, all those whatever came out in the first 2 weeks, I've come around to viewing this as a beautiful constraint, you know, to treat it that way. Mm. And so then how do you approach it with a new posture, you know, with that type of a mindset? You know, challenging for sure, but it's not a no can't don't type of challenge, you know, where that's the message. So if you treat it differently, you know, what's there, you know, what's next? And so what's next for you? What do you think is next for you?
I really like that idea, by the way, that of it being a beautiful constraint. And I suppose our constraint when we started was that we didn't have anything a museum normally has. We didn't have a building. We didn't have any objects. And when you have that constraint, all you have is the visitor or the person you interact with. So I see how that constraint turned out to be a beautiful constraint for us. So I'm just curious how this could also be a creative constraint in the same kind of way. What's next for us? I think it will depend a lot how the current situation plays out. So I can tell you what I thought was next for us was that I told you that we're 3 people and we are currently based in different cities, very far away from each other. So Peru is an enormous country. We have my co-founder is based in Cusco in the mountains. I'm in Lima on the coast. And then we have Rolando, who's another member of our team. We're right up in the north of Peru on the coast. So this was also what you might call a beautiful constraint, a big challenge for us that we were all suddenly very far apart. And what we wanted to do was to kind of turn that into a positive thing and start touring pop-ups through the country. So we wanted to develop, particularly there's, I think, in many places, there is aspects of a country's history that are not fully explored, that are kind of undervalued. And here there's a lot of romanticization and kind of obsession almost with the Incas and with certain cultures from the mountains, especially in Cusco, especially in that area. And at the same time in the north, there's a real kind of pride in that local culture. And so we wanted to move them around and kind of send things and objects and ideas from the north to the mountains and Lima and vice versa. And so our idea, and also get more, because sometimes we design a pop-up museum and we only do it once or twice. And so we wanted to come up with partnerships and concepts and then send them kind of around the country on a tour. So that was what we wanted to do. That's obviously now not going to be practical, probably until next year, to do it in that way. Another thing that I mentioned we wanted to do at the same time was develop a digital aspect to this, so that nothing very fancy. I mean, not like that we wanted to design some fancy museum website, not really that. We just wanted a way that when people say to us, oh, I know what you're talking about, that's exciting, I know something about that, how can we gather that, give people a way to contribute that and somehow archive that information, because it's really interesting. We did one about weaving and textiles, and so many people had stories about their families and about, you know, we had artisans who took part, who told us some of their practices and some of their beliefs around their weaving. And we don't have any way to archive that right now or collect that. And so we wanted to kind of build on this model we already had on Facebook of people just commenting and putting stuff and putting their own observations and somehow make that more, I don't want to say formalized, but yeah, more concrete. So that there's definitely stuff that we can still do around that. So yeah, that's what was meant to be next for us. And what maybe really is next for us is going to be a bit of a combination of building up this digital side and building up how we can communicate with people without doing in-person pop-ups for now. And then I think as things start to open up again, how we can kind of support, how we can support the return to normal or not normal, but how we can support people in their communities as they're rebuilding again after all this, and how we can provide experiences that are useful and fun again within the constraints that I'm sure there will still be constraints even when the quarantine itself is lifted. So yeah, Thinking creatively about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Alice, for your time today and for talking about your work and your wonderful project. And there is a book in this, I'm sure. Will you write a book?
Oh, well, yeah, I'd love to one day, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to reading it.
Oh, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking this through with you. I've been even making notes during our conversation of things I think we should do. And it's been really a wonderful experience to try and explain out loud everything that we do and our plans for the future. So thank you.
To learn more about Alice and Museo Waka, visit the show notes for this episode at talaterra.com. Talaterra is a podcast for and about independent educators working in natural resource fields and environmental education. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Tanya Marion.